As Roadcast has taken these first few trips, seeking to peek behind the curtain of some amazing projects and products, it has never failed to reveal simple truths. That behind many of these beautiful creations are just people. People trying and failing, trying and succeeding, and continuing to push into the creative process to create something new. And when you see that, it starts to birth confidence. That one can use their imagination and skill and begin, start, try, and you never know what might happen. I think that's why I love why we finish our California trip at the Jim Henson Creature Shop to meet with Peter Brook, the shop's creative supervisor. Peter has helped bring some of the world's most iconic characters to life for shows like Fraggle Rock, Dark Crystal, Dinosaurs, and movies like Where the Wild Things Are, Dr. Doolittle, and the Flintstones. As you get a chance to listen into the conversation and get a peek behind this specific curtain where many of our childhood dreams and imaginations were shaped, our hope is that you find your confidence bolstered in new ways to continue to create. Cheers, and we'll see you down the road.
Pete, thanks so much for being on Roadcast and letting us come into the Creature Shop. It's a huge privilege. And we greatly appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Awesome.
My pleasure to be here.
I thought maybe a fun place to start, we can go a variety of different places, but thinking about the process of bringing a character to life, mm-hmm. And kind of the design process, but I thought maybe through the lens of like a specific project. So Where the Wild Things Are, mm-hmm. I know you were involved with, which I thought was an unbelievable movie. I thought it was insanely good and subtle, and I think partly why I want to start here is that, you know, you have this like beloved children's book that lived in the imaginations of millions and millions of children, and then you're going to translate that and bring that to film, mm-hmm. and so just curious, you know, as you approach that of bringing those characters to life in puppetry and all the different elements, you know, kind of what was the process like and lessons learned. I know that's probably a huge question, but
it was a great film to be involved in, and the process was perhaps a little bit unique to that particular film, simply because you had, as you say, absolutely iconic design. You know, Maurice Sendak's illustrations and a you know, world famous book. So it wasn't like we were starting from scratch trying to come up with stuff. You know, we had the designs in a sense. So then how do you keep the essence of the, and to a certain extent the style of the of Maurice's work, and but translate it to something that is we hope believable, you know, in a sort of realistic thing. Now I will say that Spike Jones, the director, he had a great designer, Sonny Grazimovich, so Spike also had been working on the designs before he came to us, and we were also translating Maurice's work, Maurice Sendak's originals, with the work that Sonny and Spike had done, and then we're trying to both make those look a little realistic, but also translate what was essentially 2D into 3D.
Yeah.
So in the case of that film, what we did was we made maquettes, which is really just like a small sculpture model of the characters. Because as you appreciate, most of the main wild things are like 8.5 feet tall, you know, in the end.
And is it pretty typically you start with a sculpture on most
projects? Usually, yeah. Well, back in those days, yeah. I mean, nowadays we might typically do it in ZBrush or, you know, do a digital 3D model, which we can print out and what have you. But back in those days, we actually physically sculpted, you know, pretty accurate models of the characters. And again, unique to that one, we took those maquettes to a really high degree of finish, you know, with glass eyes and fur and, yeah. and you know, punching in the hair and everything. So what we ended up with was all the characters this size, and they were like beautiful models in themselves, and that's how we ended up. That was the first step, and then the second step, of course, is like, okay, you take this model and you have to blow it up 8.5
How tall were they? Because they look.
Well, they varied. I mean, Douglas was the bird was probably only about 6 foot, but the biggest ones were anywhere from 8.5 to 9
That's amazing.
Feet. Yeah, Carol was about eight and a half feet. And that in itself is a difficult challenge, you know, because there were people in suits, and one guy was really tall. Yeah, I mean, he was, you know, 6'6", 6'7" or something. but also the proportions, which we followed Maurice Sendak's designs pretty faithfully in terms of the proportions, like the large heads and smaller bodies. So that created its own challenge. And then you got the musculature and then the textures, which we had to get right, you know. And it was all filmed in Australia, you know, like the forest sequences were in a really interesting location just mm-hmm. outside of Melbourne. So that's kind of in a nutshell, that's it. But yeah, it was an interesting challenge and was difficult, you know, to pull it off eventually.
Yeah.
Because once the designs were done and we were like, okay, right, we kind of know what they're going to look like.
Yeah.
Then there was the problem of, well, how the hell are they going to move, you know? And so that was a whole
other set. Were there challenges. Animatronics, or are those suits literally just all?
Well, in the end, they weren't animatronic. No, mm-hmm. the facial expressions and stuff were achieved digitally.
Mm. We did do
a version that had animatronic, you know, mechanical functions in the face, but. We didn't use that in the end.
Okay, so it was digital rendering on the faces to kind of capture the...
Yeah. These characters from Turkey Hollow are essentially simple hand puppets. So they're operated the same way as Kermit, for example.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a hand doing the mouth. But we made them look a little bit more realistic because we sculpted them. They're not patterned in foam, as I was explaining earlier. Uh-huh. They're sculpted and then run in this foam latex material. So they look a little bit more realistic. You know, it's allowed us to individually punch in hair to give it much more of a kind of realistic skin-like texture. And then they have blinks, mechanical blinks, as well, which will bring them to life. But in their essence, it's just a hand puppet.
Yeah.
With a slightly different, a slightly more sophisticated exterior.
And is one person working this?
For the most part, sometimes it's two, in the case of these things.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it might be more, it might be three, depending on how much kind of animatronics is going on in the face, for example. But yeah, so that's kind of a simple hand puppet thing.
Okay.
But then there's other ways of, yep. let me just show you up here. These are a combination of, this is a show we did for the BBC and an Australian company. But this is a walk around. So this was a person in a suit with the mouth is operated, you know, by that person's hand inside. And then there is somebody outside of the suit with a remote control unit that's doing the eyes, the eye blinks, and the.
So there's a couple of people controlling it. Yeah,
yeah, but his whole motion, and when you say walk around, I mean he can walk around, you know, like Sweetums could in the Muppet Show.
And what's the time to take to build something like this?
Well, all these characters took about 3 months to create, and then before that there was a period of design.
Yeah,
where we were essentially dealing a lot of time with 2D, you know, sketching and then doing color stuff, mm-hmm. And then we did do sculptures of those characters.
So it really is that leap. It's like 2D and then let's sculpt it, and then from there you kind of say what materials do we want? Yeah. Do we think to pull this off at scale?
I mean, because everything here is is 3D. You know, we're not an animation. Well, I mean, we have done animation, but in the creature shop here, with everything that we make exists. It's 3D.
Yeah.
So, the sooner we can get from dealing with 2D artwork to 3D artwork, the sooner we can make that leap, the better, I find.
The quicker, yeah, yeah.
Because when we are in the 3D world, you start to see things and be able to see how the character can be improved from different angles.
Yeah.
You know, and that become that. So the sooner we can get there, the better we are, because you know you can fudge a drawing, you know you can make a drawing look good from all different angles, you know.
But once it's like
But when it's actually made, it's like, oh, well, it doesn't look so good from the profile. We thought it would, but it doesn't. So, you know, you start making some tweaks.
That's amazing.
But then the exterior covering, you know, the fur and stuff, in this instance, was much more in the Muppet realm, in a sense.
Yeah.
As opposed to what we just saw with the Turkey Hollow ones.
I think that's an interesting place, kind of, to zoom in, I think, or what I'm curious about your thoughts of. It feels like with puppetry, it kind of sits at the nexus of, like, analog and digital. Like, that there's, I don't know, people, like, really yearning for more analog experience, even in a more digital world.
Yeah.
Like, people, even, like, if you zoom out to, like, social media, and they're just like, I'm getting sick of social media.
Yeah.
I want, like, real experiences with real people. And then also that, like, I don't know, when I think about the work that you're doing, when you're bringing these characters to life, there's something that's more tangible, there's something that's more, but I don't know, I'm curious, you know, what you think about those two things. And I know sometimes they play together, like you're saying, on...
Now we're in a world where we have the best of both worlds. So, like, Wild Things was a real early version of what we call a hybrid approach, mm-hmm. which was a practical suit, you know, real textures and so on and so forth, you know, real fur, real feathers and whatnot, and yet the digital side of things could accurately manipulate the face to create really specific mm-hmm. expressions. The simple thing about puppetry is its performance, which is human, and so it's a bit. How can I explain? The human aspect of what we do, in other words, creating something practically, the craft that's involved
mm-hmm.
Of creating, whether it be a fairly simple type of puppet that you would see in, say, something like Sesame Street,
mm-hmm.
or whether it's something way more sophisticated like you would see in Age of Resistance, you know, mm-hmm. the recent Dark Crystal, you know, a couple of years ago. That level of craftsmanship is, I think we, as viewers, subconsciously realize that's actually been, it's handmade, it's human made.
Yeah. You know?
It's not being created by a button or some kind of esoteric bunch of circuitry within a computer. And so I think we respond to that, you know, and then of course when it's performed,
yeah,
that's very much like, I mean, that's very much like, you know, attending a theater show,
yeah,
in the sense that you are aware of the human performance, you know, somebody, a human is bringing this character to life.
Mm-hmm.
So that in itself is what gives puppetry its integrity.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And there are instances right now, like some of the technology you're using, like, you know, with like the motion detection, where there's people actually in costumes, but it's digitally wrapped, right? Is that
that's right. And I will say this, that I'm not saying that digital technology has no integrity at all. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's valid, and it's amazing what they can do. But there again, as you say, motion capture, good example. Is, you know, why not just animate it all in the computer?
Yeah.
Why do we have to use, you know, people in motion capture suits, despite the fact that they're going to be...
It's a great, like, question, yeah.
You know, despite the fact that they're going to be completely obliterated by a computer character. Well, again, it's the sense of human performance. It's the connection. It allows... You know, we have a whole system that allows us to... puppeteer digital characters in real time.
Mm.
So why bother puppeteering them? Why don't we just animate them? You know, well, a whole variety of reasons. Primarily, is you once again you're putting the performance in the hands of a puppeteer or a performer.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, not a bunch of animators. You know, but it's you're relying on one person to bring their sensibilities and their acting abilities and so to bring the character to life. Okay, so that's one cool aspect of it. Mm-hmm. Secondly, the way we do it allows a certain amount of freedom in terms of how you shoot the show. Mm. So the director is allowed to try different angles and, you know, different shots and so on and so forth, mm-hmm. and indeed even try different action and perhaps change a line here and there, mm-hmm. you know, very much like you would do if you were shooting a live action show, mm-hmm. to be honest. And so that in itself creates a kind of a different way of bringing characters to life. And in the end, yes, they are digital, mm-hmm. you know, but it's just a different approach.
It's like a human element.
But yeah, the core of it. Yeah, and exactly. And I mean, you know, Henson's were known for puppetry, so why would we change that? These are much more sophisticated.
And scary.
Or were much more sophisticated puppets. But also the concept was that Jim had originally for Dark Crystal was to create a film in which really they weren't supposed to be puppets, if you know what I mean. It was a new world that we were entering into, and a world that was populated by creatures of this sort of fantastical design, you know, which Brian Froud did the designs. Mm. Both for the original film and actually for Age of Resistance. So this was a different approach, and hence the amount of sort of realism that they were trying to achieve.
So this is now we're getting into, is this all animatronic at this point? Or this
well,
just...
actually, no. It still, oddly enough, was operated as a hand puppet, albeit a fairly sophisticated one. But mm-hmm. the way they operated it was that the person inside had a backpack, and this character was kind of
someone was actually in this
and their hand reached out and out to operate the head like this, so their head was probably within the torso here in the belly, and then the head was operated, but the eyes and the snarls and things like that were, back in those days, were operated through a series of cable control, which is a bit like a bike, a brake cable, you know what I mean? It's like accurate. You pull it and the eyes would blink.
Okay, kind of a random. How long can someone last on a scene? I mean, I'm imagining wearing this thing, hand over head.
Yeah, good point.
You know, I mean, is that like a...
I think it varies on the amount of action that's required. And most of the time that an actual shot is not much longer than a few minutes long, you know. Mm-hmm. But we found with, you know, over time that some performers are good for like 30 to 40 minutes, depending on the action. Mm-hmm. I mean, in this instance, it's really a case of perhaps being able to, you know, relax your arm.
Yeah.
When you're in a full-on suit, for example, or like on dinosaurs, you know, they were big full-on animatronic suits. That's a whole different deal, you know, because you're within a lot of technology and within a lot of kind of material. You know? So usually 20, 25 minutes and you kind of give somebody a break, you know. And again, it depends upon the physicality of the shot. Mm-hmm. From a design point of view, I thought I'd point out, we covered the Turkey Hollow puppets, the kind mm-hmm. of realistic looking hand puppets. But that concept, that Turkey Hollow concept, actually started in the mind of Jim Henson and to a certain extent Jerry Jewell back in the late 60s. And mm-hmm. these, in fact, excuse me, these, in fact, were Jim's and Don Salin's original puppet designs for this project, which was called Turkey Hollow. Mm. It never got made in the late 60s, and so Lisa Henson wanted to revisit the property, and it was we indeed made a movie for Lifetime in 2013 or 14, I think. Mm-hmm. I forget.
Yeah.
But, you know, in other words, a lot, you know, much later,
yeah,
should we say,
yeah.
Than when Jim came up with the idea. So these Turkey Hollow characters are, as you can imagine, in a classic, you know, Henson style. What we tried to do in the updated version was keep some of the design elements
yeah.
of these guys in the
oh yeah, you
end
can see it.
Products. So not the end products, but in the updated mm-hmm. versions. We knew we had to update the puppets to make them more realistic, but how do we still keep that kind of quality, the same abstract designs that Jim mm-hmm. was playing with? And of course the owl like guy there, see?
Yeah,
this interesting, it's not an owl, but it's got a weird owl quality. This size of eyes and the nose and stuff is what we translated in ultimately into this guy.
So are you saying there's kind of like, is there a classic kind of Henson design, like style look? You go like, hey, these are things that we've, obviously you can do a broad array of things, but.
I suppose there is. It's actually quite difficult to pinpoint mm-hmm. what that look is, because it's become kind of ubiquitous in a way, by which I mean the Muppet style, if you will,
yeah.
that style of puppet, almost defined a whole era of
yes.
puppetry, not just Henson.
Yeah, totally.
Like everyone ripped it off.
Yeah,
you know, it's because that it's. I wouldn't say rip it off, but I mean the every. You know that.
It was the
that
original
style.
There was something, yeah.
Has become the way people see puppets nowadays, especially on television.
Mm-hmm.
You know, So I imagine, I mean, if I'm designing the Henson style, I don't really know how I would do that. I think one of the things is perhaps not so much the, get bogged down with technical aspects, mm-hmm. but it's more perhaps even philosophical aspects or conceptual aspects, which is...
That's interesting.
We're not, like when I'm designing something, I'm trying to design a character. I'm not trying to follow a guideline. I'm trying to make something look alive and have a personality.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can see that in a few lines on the page, chances are that initial concept will, or that spark, if you like, will find its way to the final piece. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes beautiful sense. Yeah.
So, I don't think there's any rules like, oh, the eyes have to be this size yeah. or this has to happen or that. But you do need to feel the sense of personality in what you're drawing.
Yeah.
You know?
Do you mind if I ask, like, what was it like working with Jim Henson?
You can ask, yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, you've got to remember that I was pretty early on in my career, so I wasn't working with him.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't collaborating as a sub, yeah. like one on one with him. Mm-hmm. But I had many many interactions with him, and it was great. I mean, it was a very nice. I mean, yeah, really cool, positive. He trusted people, which is kind of a unique thing nowadays, you know.
Yeah.
In other words, you know, he'd be like, okay, I've employed you to do your job, so you go and
you
do your job,
done.
Just make sure you do it well, and you know.
Yeah.
And he was trusting and very, very nice. I mean, I can tell you a story if you want.
That would be great. Yeah, we'll take it.
Gives you kind of a sense of how he was. We did a show. We did a show called Ghosts of Fafner Hall, which is a funny old show. But it was we shot it up in the north of England, you know, and we'd built the puppets down in the London shop, and we went up to do the show, and Jim was there. This was the pilot, and Jim was there. And anyway, one night it was actually Richard Hunt's birthday and Peter Harris's birthday, and I'm trying to remember who else's birthday it was, but certainly it was Richard and Peter. So Jim had hired this banquet hall in this castle. So we all went to the castle one night to have a big sort of birthday banquet, and I just happened to be sitting next to him just before that we went into the banquet thing. And we got chit-chatting, and he said, "Oh, you know, have you ever been to New York?" I said, "No, I've never been to New York." "How do you like to go?" I said, "Oh, it'd be amazing. I'd love to go." And he said, "Yeah, we have a thing called Muppet University, and you teach, you're interested in making puppets and stuff." I said, "Absolutely, you know." Anyway, cut a long story short, you know, 3 months later or more, the person who was running the shop at the time said, "What's all this about you going to New York? I've got a fax here from Jim saying that you're expected in New York in January, you know." Sure enough. So, you know, he'd throw these little things at people, you know, just really cool. I mean, when I think about it now, I think, God, man, how sweet to...
Yeah. Pete, thanks for taking the time to chat, give us...
You're welcome.
Kind of pop the hood and let us see stuff. It's been just a privilege, so
appreciate it. Well, it's been my pleasure. I'm so glad you could join us here at the
show. Absolutely, thanks.